Blog Talk Radio.
Today, one of the greatest kings in French history, one of the longest reigning monarchs, the Sun King, Louis XIV, Louis XIV, he lived 82 years, quite a king, and of course he set up the destruction of the Bourbon monarchy. He was born today in 1638, and some people think he was a freedom fighter. Jesse James was born today. In 1847, one of the greatest musicians, violinists, a Hungarian, I guess, gypsy Jewish violinist, Joseph Sigeti, was born today. One of the great actors, Shakespearean actors, Morris Karnofsky, was born today. And probably one of the greatest directors, you remember The Longest Day, among his films, Darryl Zanuck, was born in Wahoo, Nebraska. Also, Howard Hanson, the great American musical educator, conductor, composer. He worked at the Eastman School of Music in Rochester, New York. He was also born in Wahoo, Nebraska, but his birthday isn't today. We will honor him on his birthday. He wrote some very beautiful music. And Arthur Koestler wrote The Darkness at Noon about totalitarianism. He was born today. And we had Jack Valenti, who was a Texan with an Italian name. He worked very closely with LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, and when Lyndon was president, Valenti reportedly said, "I sleep soundly at night because Lyndon is president," something like that. Also, Paul Volcker, controversial head of the Federal Reserve, a big bear of a man. Some people think he was overbearing. He was born today in 1927, 2 years before the market crash in 1929. Very controversial, touchy-feely type. He adopted the name Werner Erhard. He was born today, 1935. He started EST, which is a controversial, touchy-feely, one of those feel-good type mind manipulation cults, as it were. Very popular in parts of California. And one of the great buxom actresses. She's probably infamous for starring in Myra Breckinridge. Raquel Welch was born in 1940 in Chicago. Great composer and conductor, one of the great Mexican musical conductors, Eduardo Mata, was born in 1942. I guess the only most interesting death in 1981 was one of those crazy Ayatollahs. Ayatollah Ali, I can't pronounce his name, Khudai, he was assassinated. He was the prosecutor general of Iran. And, of course, a lot of people who were tired of this international terrorism under the guise of religion and Islam wished that more of these guys would just go away before they have to be taken off the world stage. Among the events today, in 1774, the Continental Congress met. In 1781, this was the beginning of the end of the British occupation and colonial empire here in this part of North America. The French Navy defeated the British Navy, and that boxed in Cornwallis, Lord Cornwallis. Interesting man. There's a movie called Lafayette. It was a French-English version, and Cornwallis was played by, I forgot his name, Jack, great British actor, never knighted, and he referred to Lafayette as that damn boy. And, of course, the French fleet, when it defeated the British fleet off of in Virginia, was one of the only times that the French defeated the British Navy. The next time the British met the French fleet was at Trafalgar, and Lord Horatio Nelson obliterated the French Navy. Also today, this is a big day in Texas, Sam Houston was elected president of the Republic of Texas. A lot of people don't know that after the Americans who became Texans, and technically were Mexican citizens, that was the deal, they set up, after they defeated Santa Ana, they set up the Republic of Texas. And some people think it ought to go back to that. And then this is very relevant today because a lot of people cannot afford to fill up their cars and SUVs and trucks. In 1885, the first gasoline pump was delivered to a gas station. Of course, people are wishing they'd deliver gas at a much lower price. I can remember when it was 19 cents a gallon back in the 60s. And this is one of my favorites. In 1905, the Treaty of Portsmouth was signed by ending the Russo-Japanese War. We have some interesting video involving the last two Russian naval ships that visited San Francisco, port visit, and, of course, the connection to the Russo-Japanese War, which is also has a connection to San Francisco through the famous journalist and author Jack London, who was born here. A lot of people don't know that. He also owned a winery called Valley of the Moon. Great journalist. Unfortunately, he died early. And then in 1953, the first privately operated nuclear reactor was set up in Raleigh, North Carolina. And, of course, now they're concerned because of the hurricanes that these reactors may have been damaged, or they can't trust them to put them back online to provide electricity to the areas which they serve. And then the first color video recording magnetic tape was presented in Raleigh, North Carolina, in 1958. And this is relevant. We've been asked to replay Jack Phillips, the technical godfather of a lot of California's broadcast technicians. So he talks about some of these developments in his 50 years involved in the industry. He's retired now, and this is a rare interview. That's the only one he ever did. And I've been asked to replay it, which we will do right now.
I mean, just make sure I got the volume here. Oh, you look great, Jeff. Let me just make sure I got the volume here.
The TV industry started right after World War II, late 40s. First channel on the air was KPIX.
That's San Francisco.
San Francisco.
Was it owned by CBS?
I don't remember who owned them. I think it might very well have been. It was CBS as far back as I can remember. And they had their transmitter on top of and some studios in the Mark Hopkins Hotel. And a lot of the TV stations staffed them with people that were working for them, the radio stations that they also owned. For instance, CBS had a radio station, and
KCBS, like.
Pardon?
KCBS.
KCBS, yeah. Mm-hmm. And NBC had a radio station. Mm-hmm. And
Westinghouse, Channel 7.
Channel 7 was
ABC.
KGO, yeah, mm-hmm. ABC. And their original staff was people that moved into TV from radio, because the people that were available, that was it. There wasn't any TV people really available, particularly on the technical side. TV was a whole new industry. And at that time, the whole technical world required a lot of maintenance, because it was all vacuum tubes. The vacuum tubes are like light globes. They have a finite life. They burn out after a few hundred or a couple of thousand hours. And so they needed technical staff. And I had worked as a technician first in the coin machine business, and then some other things, and ultimately worked in TV, and KALW was part of the TV training program at the O'Connell School in San Francisco, and it was partially funded by MDTA, and that was Manpower Development and Training Act that was federally put together from World War II. And I went to work there in 1966 in the electronics department. And if a student came in that wanted to be an electronic technician, he was almost guaranteed a job, because there just weren't enough of those guys. And some of the equipment that the TV stations had at the end of the 50s and in the early 60s was very complex for its day. And required a lot of maintenance. A videotape machine was in use in the broadcast trade before we even knew tape for audio existed. And the machines were very complex and very troublesome.
Jack, some people prefer vacuum tubes. Like the old Macintosh amplifiers and that. Are they superior to the new development? A choice?
Finish.
Ah.
Okay. And you know, they worked, and they worked well. They're beautiful amplifiers, but you can get a better amplifier today for a lot less money. The interesting thing about it is that most of the distortion in an audio system at the low frequency end is generated by the loudspeakers. Nobody seems to ever talk about it, though.
Mm.
Okay.
So, like the subwoofers, the
but that's where the
distortion is.
Low frequency, the woofers, and the subwoofers.
Could you offset that with a frequency machine equalizer?
No, it has to do with the with the physical size of the parts in a loudspeaker. There's a saying in the trade that says you can't get big sound out of a small box. And for big low frequency sound, you need big loudspeakers and big amplifiers. But anyway, back to the O'Connell School. In the O'Connell School, there was an electronics department, and there were four or five of us on the third floor, and on the fifth floor, there was KALW, and one man, Ken Nielsen, and he had been there for a lot of years when I went there, and he was approaching retirement. KALW radio was on the air a few hours a day. There was not the demand for and the desire for and the money for a radio station that there is today. And so KALW first went on the air right after World War II. And back in the 50s, late 40s, and it had been in the works for a long time. I don't know how long.
What was the first school district-owned station west of the Mississippi?
It was the first district-owned station. And as I said, was on the air for, they turn it on and run it for a couple of hours to train people what to do in a radio station from the technical end. And they also learned a little about how to sit in front of a microphone. In 1970, give or take a couple of years, I'm going to say 69, maybe 70, 71, somewhere in there. The demand for band space, bandwidth, room for another radio station began to increase for FM. It had already been there for AM, and the Federal Communications Commission, or FCC, had pretty good control over AM radio, and it was necessary if you were in AM radio in order to be there. You had to be there, so to speak. And there were a lot of stations that were on the air 24 hours a day. We could run, for training purposes, we could run an FM station and turn it on once a week, shut it down for the summer vacation. And then the Federal Communications Commissions came in and said that you're going to lose your license because there are people that want it. And so we realized that it was a case of either use it or lose it. And so we had to upgrade KALW from a part-time training school to a full-time on-the-air 14, 15 hours a day, maybe 18 hours a day, I don't remember which. And Ken Nielsen, that had been teaching the program, was moved to manager of the radio station. Shortly thereafter, Ted Samuel and Leon Del Grande came in as the program director, and so on and so forth. Ken became the chief engineer, and I took over the training part of it. and that would have been early 1970s. I was there for 20 some odd years before I retired. I don't remember any exact dates, so these dates are loose. At the time I left, the industry was in a big dip. It was entirely different than it was when I first started. I had people calling me from all over the country saying, I understand you have a training program for technicians, and you could put them anywhere they wanted to go. We had, I think there was two or three of them over that time went to work for CBS New York. And at one time, a good portion of the people working in the technical end of the broadcast business were people that I had been involved in the training with. Then in 1970s, that began to change because the videotape machine that I mentioned earlier had moved up. It was less troublesome. You didn't have to have a technician there to hold its hand all day. Today, videotape is a thing of the past. We have little disc recorders, or in some cases, full solid-state big chips that will store program material. Relatively trouble-free. And where you, if you were a major market station like any of those here in San Francisco during the 60s and early 70s, you had to have a technician on hand 24 hours a day. Today, the vacuum tube is gone. All of the equipment, not all of it, but a large portion of the equipment is throwaway, because where the old videotape machines cost $250,000, the ones today cost $250, $300, $500, and they're throwaways. When it quits working, you throw it out. And that's kind of the way it is. And of course, the need for a training program is gone.
So if a young person was coming to you and they say, Jack, based on your experience, could you give me some advice on should I go into the broadcasting industry? Is it going to be a lifetime job guarantee, or like as some artists say, you better have another job?
Well, I would say in this world, as fast as things are moving, I wouldn't depend upon any job to be a lifetime job. That's the way it is. A lot of people do. And I don't know if I would go into the broadcast business or not. There are bankruptcies occurring, and that was unheard of 30 years ago.
What about these broadcasting schools? Are they, do you have an opinion on those?
As I said, I don't think the employment opportunities are there.
Maybe.
Well, yes, there's a job pops up every now and then, but it's always for a seasoned technician, somebody. You know, you might have to go out and do something else for a while, get get your basic electronics together, and then take what you can get, and keep your eyes open. And maybe after a while get something a little more complex, but get your basics together first.
Do you have any views on shortwave radio?
On what?
Shortwave radio.
Oh, communications radio is, you know, like cell phones. There's millions of them. It's a big industry. TV, community TV or cable TV or whatever you want to call it, is important and it's there. I don't know how they pay.
Very little, I understand, of anything.
Yeah, I would suspect that they're not real big.
Some of it's ego.
Pardon?
Some of it's ego. You get your face on the tube.
Yeah, no, I don't know. If I were a young person just getting out of school, I'd go out and grab what I could get right now. I mean, it's a tough market in any of the fields. And don't expect to become a millionaire overnight. But there always is employment for good electromechanical type persons, people that can get into an electromechanical system and are good screwdriver operators, people that can fix things, tinkerers. These people aren't going to make an awful lot of money, but they always get by. And, you know, I mean, I speak from my own experience. I never had to go down to the state office of employment, sign up for unemployment insurance or anything.
Now, some of these schools, I think it's like ITT, you see these ads on TV for technical training. Are they of any value, or are they hustles, or what?
There is some value, but, again, when TV first hit the market, a good TV set was $400.
Oh, yeah, very expensive. Small tube, small screen.
Yeah, a little 12-inch screen thing was $400 or $500, and that number stayed there. When color came along, it was still $500, partly because production costs had gone down and partly because dollar value had gone down. And even today you can buy a pretty nice TV set for $400 with today's dollar, which is worth a fourth of what it was, or a tenth of what it was.
Now, those TVs, when they broke down, there were all these TV repair shops. Today, what are they making? Just throw away TVs, get another one?
Yeah. Well, you look at it. If it's something that you can replace at a reasonable price, but finding components is difficult for them. And as I said, the days of the vacuum tube where you can just pull one out and stick another one in and it's fixed, that's over with. It's sort of the parallel that I draw is sort of like that of the automobile. In the World War II days and afterward for quite a while, if you lifted the hood of your car up and looked at the engine, you saw an engine, and you saw some wires that went to some spark plugs and all that sort of stuff. And a guy that had some mechanical
ability
or affinity could fix it. You could do it yourself. You can't do can't do car repair yourself anymore.
Yeah, you need a computer and a technician.
You need a technician, and finding parts is difficult.
Yeah.
And expensive. And so the TV business is the same way. At both the production of programming area, at the TV station itself, the broadcast facility, and at the TV reception, your TV receiver. All of it has changed dramatically from what it was 40 years ago, 50 years ago. And it will continue to change.
Finally, Jack, Leo Lee used to say, you know, the founder of Western Public Radio, where I studied, that when you come into the Western Public Radio, leave that F outside, your politics and agenda. Do you think that some of these people today, or a growing number of media people, are bringing their political and sexual preference agenda into the studios?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I never had anything to do with that end of it. I never made any decisions as to what we would carry in the way of programs. There were people around that were interested in that end of it, but I never was really interested in the program. I had plenty to do. But there were people around that wanted their world their way. I don't know. Well, I just don't know. I don't want to get into that part of that world.
We see it every day anyway. We know who these people are.
Well, I don't know who said it. I heard some commentary one day on TV talking about people's knowledge of the world around them, where and why and what and how, and this person commented that people that wear green glasses don't see the whole picture. And I think that's true. When you let your politics get into your place of employment, you're making a mistake. And a lot of people do it. The other thing, politically, I notice about the political world, TV, print, people don't understand the concept even, or the words. But when they get behind something, they're behind it, and to the point where any facts contrary to what they wish for are unimportant, and they have completely ignored the concept of cost-benefit analysis. Shall we do this? Oh, yeah, that's a good idea, wonderful, whoopee-doo. But if we do this, the unanticipated consequences could be horrendous. And I see less and less of that kind of analytical thinking all the time.
So it's more agenda instead of experience and expertise?
Oh, absolutely. It's more agenda than anything. And we'll take care of our agenda, and if it happens to hurt you, that's just too bad. So I don't know.
Well, thank you, Jack, through this walk through broadcasting history.
Well, I don't know.
It's been very interesting because you've seen, about, what, 50 years of it?
Yeah.
So there's hardly anybody around like you.
Well, there are a few of us around, but we're all old boogers.
Thank you, Jack Phillips, for being on the program. This is Teacher Paul Brizola. Thanks for viewing and listening.
Hope you're
going to... Well, that was the great Jack Phillips. He was a masterful electrician. Thank God he's still alive. He's taught a lot of people. And anybody who's interested in the broadcast field should listen very carefully to his words of wisdom. You're not going to get that from anybody else. Some of the talking heads on both the alternative and commercial broadcasting. Among the other events today, we had, and this is a memorial, in 1972, 11 Israeli athletes who were going to participate and compete in the Olympics at Munich, an interesting place, they were murdered. They were slain, horrible things by terrorists. And we should never forget that. They really polluted the games with this violence because the Olympics started by, modern Olympics started by Baron de Coubertin, Frenchman, was supposed to be all the nations were to put us to get together to compete fairly on the fields without bringing in their political baggage, a sexual preference, and all of that BS. And just be athletes and compete in a friendly manner, fair, and then move on and be better people, better human beings. And maybe nations would take, the political leaders of nations could take a lesson from the young people getting together, competing fairly on the athletic field. But that didn't happen. And we've had the problem also when Carter refused to allow American athletes to participate in the Olympics that were held in Moscow. He injected American politics into the Olympic Games, and it was a disaster. Of course, his presidency went down the tubes, considering that he worked in a nuclear submarine field. I guess he was blown out of the water politically. In 1975, a few years later, Squeaky Fromm, Lynette Fromm, she tried to assassinate President Ford. There were two attempted assassinations of Ford, both here in California. One was in Union Square by, not Squeaky Fromm, but I forgot her name. And I think she's still in prison. She tried to shoot Ford. And interestingly, there was a former military veteran who happened to be gay, but he wasn't political. He saved Ford's life. And then it was that awful columnist that... I don't even know how to describe him. Herb Cain, who stayed around too long and became... He didn't even write the column. It was Carol Vernier who wrote the column for him at the Chronicle. He publicized the fact that this guy was gay in his private life, and this guy had kept it private. He wasn't a political activist, and his family found out about it, caused him a lot of problems, a lot of grief, that it was needlessly caused by this it was Walter Winchell type of, I won't call him a journalist, but a gossip writer. But some other things that Herb Cain did, and we'll get into that another day. Also today, we had Mountbatten's funeral in Burma. I don't know why. He was known in World War II. Mountbatten was the cousin of Queen Elizabeth the second, and very controversial. He was assassinated. He was with his nephew, grandson. He had a daughter, and she had two sons, and another kid. And the boat was blown up by IRA terrorists. It was alleged that Mountbatten was gay in his private life, and it was. Well, we'll leave it at that. But anyway, he was known as Mountbatten of Burma because he was commander-in-chief, a supreme Allied commander during World War II of the Allied effort in the that part of the Pacific. MacArthur was the supreme commander in another part of the Pacific. And the reason that Mountbatten, he was in the Navy. It was a famous movie depicting his heroics in a ship that was sunk. It was called In Which We Serve. Noel Coward served in it, starred in it, and was about the Kelly, which was, I think, a destroyer that was sunk by a torpedo in the Mediterranean. And Mountbatten, Earl Mountbatten, as he later became known, as was appointed Supreme Allied Commander in the, I think, the Southeastern Pacific. And Burma was part of that. And he dealt with people like General Vinegar Joe Stilwell, people like that. So we'll be back Wednesday, and we'll have more audio interviews. And we're going through our archives. We've still got about 1,000 to go through. And also fresh stuff that we're doing. So we'll end today. I still got this bloody cold. We'll end with our usual theme. Where is it? We're going to get it here. Uh-oh. Politics and poker. And it better be here. It has disappeared. We'd like to end with that. And there'll be more on the... excuse me, on the upcoming election. There's some more things on Mr. Rowe that have come up. And Hannity, he's raised some interesting questions. At least he's one guy. A lot of people don't agree with him, but at least he raises questions that need to be addressed, need to be answered, and we shouldn't be stonewalled on getting some of the answers. He knows how to deal with these people who avoid dealing with... giving straight answers, no pun intended. So we'll end with our usual ending theme. Here goes.
What do you say, Ben? Want a hand?
No, you guys go ahead. I got too much on my mind to play poker.
King bets.
Cost you five. Tony, up to you.
Okay, Tony, what are you going to do?
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Me too.
Hit me with a
kick.
Gentlemen, here we are, and one thing is clear. We gotta pick a candidate for Congress this year. Big ace.
Ace bet.
You'll pay through the nose.
Okay, where do you stand?
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Here goes.
Possible straight, possible flush, nothing.
Gentlemen, how about some names we can use? Some qualified Republican who's willing to lose.
I suppose we should make Jack Riley the guy.
Which Riley are you thinking of, Jack B or Jack Y?
I say, neither one. I never even met him.
I say, when you got a pair of jacks, bet out.
Politics and poker, politics and poker, shuffle up and cards and find the joker. He's a game for children, he's a game is rough.
Politics or poker, which is more important?
Parrot raise.
Bet 'em.
Little trade, good as gold.
I'll stay.
Raise your mind.
I'll fall.
I'll hold.
I'll raise your back.
I think you're bluffing.
Put your money where your mouth is.
Okay, I'm in.
Gentlemen, knock it off and let's get this done.
Try Michael Panyachinkovich, I'm certain he'd run.
Mike is out, I'm afraid he just wouldn't sell. Nobody likes a candidate whose name they can't spell. How about...
That's probably what happened to Polenti, and I kept saying it. And of course, he was mediocre to begin with. Anyway, this is Peter Paul Vizzolan. Be back Wednesday. Good night. This will be up in the archives. And I think you can download it on iPod. Good night.